Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link program, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany, this Tuesday, the 15th of November 2016. I am Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I'm Stella Oneko, and I'll be telling you what's trending on the different social media platforms.
In today's program, DRC's President Joseph Kabila addresses Parliament a day after his Prime Minister resigned. But what does this tell us about the future of the country? We hear from an analyst.
So this was a move by the Congolese cabinet and by the Prime Minister to basically shore up Kabila's power and to give him the time now to potentially rig the elections in 2018.
9 people confirmed dead as police clash with Shiite Muslims in Nigeria. Analysts warn that heavy-handed response is fueling tensions.
The government should be futuristic in decision-making. There might be a possibility of them metamorphosing to become a threat, just like Boko Haram has become to Nigerian government.
And we'll be looking at food security in Nigeria and what you've been saying about that.
Stay with us for all this and more, but first let's listen to what's happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. German police early on Tuesday have carried out raids across the country targeting suspected members of the Islamic True Religion Salafist group who have come under fire for their controversial and strict interpretation of the Quran. We go to DW's Thomas Sparrow for more.
Interior Minister Thomas de Maizière announced that this organization has been banned after these raids in 10 German states, which involved nearly 190 searches of homes, offices, mosques. He once again stressed that this organization is known here in Germany after its campaign in major German cities to distribute free copies of the Quran. But according to Interior Minister Thomas de Maizière, that campaign also was used to spread hate speech.
German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier has arrived in Turkey, where he's likely to discuss with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on the country's widespread crackdown on dissident voices. Ahead of the trip, Steinmeier said democracy and civil society has been threatened in Turkey, as Erdogan's mass purge has led to more than 100,000 officials being dismissed from their positions after the failed coup attempt in July. Meanwhile, DW has published texts from the Turkish newspaper Cumhuriyet in solidarity with Writers in Prison Day. Cumhuriyet's editor-in-chief and several journalists were arrested as part of Erdogan's crackdown. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. The International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor has said the U.S. may have committed war crimes in Afghanistan between 2003 and 2014. The ICC reported that the alleged crimes of torture by military forces on Afghans were committed as part of a policy on interrogation. U.S. citizens could face prosecution if found guilty. It is the first case the ICC has suspected the U.S. of war crimes. Meanwhile, the West African country of Gambia has notified the ICC that it would leave in November of next year. Gambia's information minister expressed dissatisfaction with the ICC's humiliating persecution on people of color, especially Africans. It is the third country after South Africa and Burundi to leave. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has expressed regret over the decision. Outgoing U.S. President Barack Obama arrived in Greece on his final official foreign trip. Speaking with his Greek counterpart, Obama thanked Greece for its contribution to NATO and his readiness to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Greek people.
Greece has gone through very challenging economic times. It has been the policy of my administration to do everything we can to work with the Greek government and the Greek people. The strong NATO relationship between the United States and Greece is of the utmost importance.
And now in sports, Germany's final international match of the year is against Italy in Milan on Tuesday night. Though the game is only a friendly, German coach Joachim Löw has said he expects to face a typically well-organized Italian team. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
We begin the program in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where President Joseph Kabila addressed Parliament a day after his Prime Minister Augustin Matata Ponyo stepped down. The President blamed the current political instability in the country on opposition, but hinted his readiness for dialogue. On Monday, the government announced a clampdown on foreign media by limiting their broadcast hours. It described foreign media as mouthpieces of the opposition. Let's hear some reactions from media analysts in the region.
Pushing the envelope as far as he can and determining, you know, how far he can go to cement his grip on power.
The interruption of radio signals of RFI, UN Radio and Radio Kapi constitute a violation of press freedom, which is unacceptable in a democratic country, especially at this time when the Congolese people have to follow closely developments in the country ahead of elections.
The sad thing is we're not hearing a lot of complaints from outside the DRC about this clampdown on media freedom. My fear is that the UN peacekeeping mission is not as robust as it used to be, knowing that the relationship between MONUSCO, the peacekeeping mission, and Kabila and his administration has deteriorated over the years. I fear that perhaps the UN might not want to rock the boat with regarding its shaky links with Mr. Kabila and may just remain silent on this.
Media analysts in the region reacting to Kabila's hold on to power and a clampdown on international media. And to find out if Matata's resignation could put pressure on Kabila to respect the constitution, I've been speaking to Phil Clark of SOAS, University of London. Take a listen.
The resignation of Augustin Ponyo, the Prime Minister, really paves the way now for Kabila to remain in the presidency until the elections in 2018. So this was a move by the Congolese cabinet and by the Prime Minister to basically shore up Kabila's power and to give him the time now to potentially rig the elections in 2018 and to potentially change the constitution to allow him to run for a third term.
In other words, his resignation is rather not in protest to President Kabila, but some kind of a well-planned move within the cabinet.
That's right. The move really is now designed to create a government of unity. This agreement that came out of discussions between the government and the opposition over the last few weeks says that the only way that a Kabila can remain as president leading up to the next elections is if the current cabinet is dissolved and a government of unity is created. So basically, the cabinet and the prime minister have obeyed Kabila's orders.
Today, everybody was anxious to hear what the president tells the parliament when he addressed it. Unfortunately, for many people, the president remained silent. He did not mention whether or not he will be contesting. What do you make of this silence?
This silence by Kabila today speaks volumes. I think it shows that he doesn't want to inflame the current situation. He doesn't want to play his political cards too quickly.
Now, the president has also blamed the youth who are most often involved in instability within the country. He says that they are being misled by the opposition leaders. Is this suggest that the people of Congo still want him for presidency, say for the opposition?
There seems to be a great deal of discontent with Kabila's government right across Congo. And in the past, we've seen protests in one or two urban centres. But what's different this time is that the protests have taken place in all urban centres across the country. And it's not just young people protesting. It's trade unions. It's teachers and lecturers. And it's even small crops of the rural population have also been out in force, protesting against the idea that Kabila could run for a third term. This, I think, shows that the depth of opposition to Kabila running again. And every time there has been a major protest in an urban centre, the government has cracked down violently against those protesters. Unfortunately, I think that is a cycle of protest and government violence that is likely to continue until these elections are held in 2018.
Now, the UN Security Council is currently in the country, and Alexis Lamek, who is leading the team, said they were concerned about government's decree on foreign media. Could their presence in the country actually encourage President Kabila to reverse his government's decision on broadcasting hours of foreign media?
I think the decision by the Congolese government to jam the radio transmissions by Radio France Internationale and Radio Okapi this weekend was designed deliberately to coincide with the UN's visit. I in fact think that the reason the Congolese government did this was to send a very direct message to the UN delegation and to the international community as a whole that Congo will not tolerate any meddling in their political affairs. This was a move that the government has been considering for a long time, but they deliberately cracked down on the international media this weekend at the same time as the UN's visit to try and make this this statement very clear. And so I think this shows the intentions of Kabila's government, that he is already putting in place the pieces for him to run for a third term, and any attempt by the donors and by the international community to change this course are likely to be futile.
I was speaking to Phil Clark from SOAS, University of London. Now, the US soldiers could be indicted by the International Criminal Court despite the US not being a member of the court. A newly released report accuses them of torturing detainees in Afghanistan. The report further indicates that the CIA may have committed war crimes by torturing detainees in Poland, Romania, and Lithuania. Washington has not yet responded to the report. Malte Rover-Kalman has more.
U.S. soldiers allegedly tortured at least 60 detainees in Afghanistan. CIA operatives supposedly did the same to almost 30 detainees in Afghanistan and several Eastern European countries. If the prosecution now opts to file a full investigation, the case could move on, as Thijs Bouwknecht from the University of Amsterdam explains.
So once that happens, it means that the ICC prosecutor can actually travel to Afghanistan, start hear witnesses, and if there are enough witnesses and enough evidence, then she can proceed to charge persons. And this may include U.S. nationals.
So far, the ICC has only tried crimes committed in Africa. More than 120 countries fall under its jurisdiction, but not the United States. It could still prosecute the U.S. nationals, as they allegedly committed the offenses on member states' soil. It's also a court of last resort, which means it only prosecutes if national legal systems fail to do so, as Bouwknecht further explains.
I think the real impetus for this document to be publicized is that the prosecutor actually hopes that the US will prosecute and investigate these cases themselves, and then the ICC becomes unnecessary.
The US Foreign Affairs Ministry already said the US legal system could look into the allegations themselves. Now it's on the ICC's prosecution to decide if they should move the case ahead anyway.
Malte Rover-Kalman. In Nigeria, clashes between the police and the Shiite Muslims continue. At least 9 people, including a police sergeant, were killed and several wounded in the outskirts of Kano State. The violence broke out on Monday when police tried to disperse thousands of members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria who had embarked on their annual Araben walk from Kano to Zaria. In Kaduna State, Muhammad Alamin with the details.
Police in Kano have alleged that thousands of Shia members observing the annual Arba'in attack innocent citizens, damaging public and personal properties, thereby causing mayhem that could lead to the general disturbances of the public peace in the state. While trying to restore law and order, Shia members attacked the police, killing one policeman and critically injured others. But the leader of the IMN in Kano, Malam Sunusi Abdul Qadir Koki, denied the allegation, saying the annual Arba'in trekking was not a new thing in Kano, adding that the procession has been conducted in the state for the last 5 years without any hitch. The Kano State Commissioner of Police said a sergeant and 8 Shiites were killed in the violence, but the IMN say the number of the casualties were more than the figure given by the police. Experts warn that a heavy-handed Nigerian response to the sectarian issue is fueling tension at a time when the security forces are already overstretched fighting Boko Haram jihadists in the northeastern Nigeria and the Niger Delta militants in the south. Sani Adamu Jauru, a political analyst from Gombe State University, said the federal government should be more cautious to avoid such incidences happens again, lest they turn out an insurgency.
The government should be futuristic in decision-making. There might be a possibility of them metamorphosing to become a threat, just like Boko Haram has become to Nigerian government. If you recall back in 2009, this is how the situation of Boko Haram started. The detention, the killings of their members, and of course their leader.
Monday's killing came just about a year after more than 300 Shiites lost their life during a clash with the soldiers. They had been accused of blocking a major road in Kaduna State during a procession.
In case you've just tuned in, this is DW's Africa Link programs coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I am Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I'm Sela Oneko.
Still to come, meet the Hazza fruit gatherers and hunters who have embraced modern technology.
We use tools to record where we have been on patrol and we take pictures. If we come across an area where someone has destroyed trees, we take pictures using a GPS device which automatically records the location.
And for the astronomers amongst you, we'll be looking at last night's supermoon.
In Malawi, primary school children aged between 10 and 14 walk an average of 20 kilometers per day to school. Not so many can take a challenge, hence the dropout rate is high. Malawi's education policy entails that a school be established within a radius of 5 to 6 kilometers, but this only remains on paper. Despite the hardships, rural learners face, they have to compete with their counterparts in urban areas with relatively better learning conditions. From Lilongwe, George Mango reports.
Fourteen-year-old Tuongeyona wakes up at 4 a.m. She does all the chores as her parents go farming every morning. She is always late for classes, even if she abandons such chores. The young girl walks a distance of 20 kilometers daily to and from school. Oftentimes, she misses the first lesson. Yona's performance is not impressive.
I'm passing through difficult times. I cherish to be the best in class, but things are not working. For instance, just this morning before coming here, I had to wash dishes, draw water, and sweep the surroundings since my parents are out in the field doing land preparation. I arrive late for lessons and I'm locked outside. The distance is just too much for me, as you can see. And it is not only me who arrives late for classes, but many of my friends in this area.
The story of Tiwonga is just a tip of the iceberg. On average, most of the children walk for 2 to 3 hours before they get into classes. This means they either get to school late or too tired to attend to lessons. Education commentators say pupils based in towns are better off as they use public transport or are dropped at school by their parents. But one thing is common. They both fight for the same space in public secondary schools during primary school leaving examinations. Ruben Chikuni is head teacher at Chimala.
The main problem is that when a teacher is serious to study his lesson in time, it is the time when other learners are not yet reported for the lessons. So with the assistance we have, from World Vision to have the bicycles, I think our performance for punctuality will be improved.
World Bicycle Relief and World Vision are giving out bicycles to pupils, especially girls, to ease the transport problem. The two organizations are jointly mobilizing learners through the power of bicycles to help them conquer the challenge of distance, achieve educational independence, and thrive in life. Chigombuso Kamwendo is the program's manager for World Vision in Chisi District, one of the affected areas in Malawi.
This calls for joint efforts if we are to promote the education in primary schools. It would be ideal if other organizations come in and use the same model of distributing bicycles to learners who walk long distances. As World Vision, we will try to work with stakeholders such as government to ensure that children attend good education.
For many people in rural regions of developing countries like Malawi, where poverty is norm, walking is the only mode of transport. But now a Buffalo bicycle will offer immediate benefit of reliable access to education.
George Mango in Lilongwe. Later on in the program, Sela will be joining me to discuss what people are saying on social media. But first, Africa on the Move.
Africa on the Move.
Well, if you thought hunters and gatherers were long gone, you were wrong, as you are bound to meet the Hadza or Hadzabi people. Having survived extinction, there are just about 1,000 Hadza living in north-central Tanzania. Some 300 to 400 of them still live as they did centuries ago. But despite their lifestyle, the Hadza just won't be left behind in today's world of technology. They have fully embraced it. Lucy Taylor tells us how and why in her report presented by Isaac Mugabe.
The Hadza people have lived in the remote Yaeda Valley in their traditional ways for 10,000 years. They still rely on the forest for hunting game meat and gathering fruits. And even whistling to birds, which leads them to honey. But today, their land is under threat. Trees have been cut down, threatening their survival.
We hate to see trees being cut down like this. It is very painful.
The forest guards patrol the area looking for signs of damage. Filippo and his team use GPS satellite tracking to collect evidence of the destruction.
We use tools to record where we have been on patrol and we take pictures. If we come across an area where someone has destroyed trees, we take pictures using a GPS device which automatically records the location.
The problem is the competition for this land. Other tribes need space for farming and cattle grazing. And in places, that means the natural habitat is completely destroyed. Filippo is devastated.
You can see the state of it. It is devastating the way they are farming this land. Now, where are the Hadza people going to live?
To stop the destruction, it is now illegal to cut down trees on Hadza land. And where the patrols find damage, they can arrest or report the offenders will face a fine. Isaac Bryson is the project officer at Carbon Tanzania, a social enterprise with an innovative approach to the conservation of community-owned forests in Tanzania. He is in regular contact with the forest guards.
Everything you can see below me here is the land of the Hadza people. This is where we live. We depend on this land to get our meat and our honey. This is what we call our home.
This project is funded by the Global Carbon Credit Scheme, where businesses offset their emissions by contributing money to projects that reduce carbon. The villagers are given payments twice a year of thousands of dollars, and the patrols also work with other tribes in the area to voice their concerns about the environment. Filippo is proud of his homeland.
I feel very happy when I see how we have looked after this beautiful land. Before, when I saw the land being destroyed, I hated it. But now that I see it is being protected, I feel happy.
That report was compiled by Lucy Taylor.
Focus Europe.
And now to Italy, where authorities are struggling to find a good solution for the refugees as the refugee centres are overcrowded, yet more people continue to flock in every day. The history and philosophy teacher Antonio Carlo from the northern town of Treviso thinks he has the solution for the people, opening up your own home to welcome them. Angelo van Scherak reports from Treviso.
Shaka is in the kitchen preparing African chicken for 12 people. He's one of six refugees who've been living with the Calò family for over a year now. 15 months ago, Antonio Calò, his wife Nicoletta and their four adult children decided to give shelter to immigrants in their own home, a small villa in a small town just outside Treviso.
In April last year, after another tragedy in the Mediterranean, we decided we wanted to do something. But the only thing we could do was open up our home. I discussed it with my wife and children, and they were okay with the idea. so I let the local authorities know. They thought we were mad because we were making our own home available, not some second house. After a while, they sent us 6 young African guys, and that's how our adventure started.
While preparations for dinner continue, Mohammed is lying flat out on the couch, tired after a day's work. An app on his phone provides the call for prayer. Mohammed is 27 years old and comes from Gambia.
I had to flee Gambia because of a problem with the president. But no, I don't want to talk about it too much.
When I ask about his past, Mohammed is nervous. He plays with the headphones of his mobile phone, wiggles his leg, and stares in the distance. Antonio's son, Giovanni, plays the piano. He studies at a conservatory in Basel, Switzerland. A year ago, he suddenly found 6 strangers were sharing his home.
My parents told us what they had in mind, and I agreed with their decision. But I have to admit, it was hard at first, 6 more people around the house. But now, I think it's great.
Mario Conte is a member of the Municipal Council of Treviso for the Anti-Immigration Party Northern League. He is not particularly pleased with Mr. Calò's decision to house immigrants.
What I have against the whole thing is that it's become a business, also for Mr. Calò, because he gets 30 euros per refugee per day. In my opinion, that isn't just taking care of refugees, it's business.
Italy is struggling with 150,000 refugees in centres all over the country. Every day the number increases, and the authorities don't know where to put them anymore. Antonio Calò says the solution is for Italians to take them into their own homes.
Angelo Fanchirek in Treviso.
Now, in Nigeria, there's another issue that's plaguing the country, and that is food security. Several international organizations like Save the Children and the UN have said that especially children in northern Nigeria and those who have been displaced by Boko Haram insurgency will need food aid.
And we posted that report on our Facebook page and got some responses.
Yes, and Oluwafemi Samuel Ogunbeni said, God help us in Nigeria, we citizens are fed up of this economy. Another user, another follower called Isaac Ehosa Godwin said, since the beginning of the Boko Haram crisis, Nigeria has never been the same.
But just to remind you what's all about, we actually see a supermoon when the moon is at its closest point on the earth. And depending on how you see it, it can appear even bigger.
That's the topic on the supermoon. That's our next topic, which has also been discussed a lot on social media, which is about pictures about the supermoon, which was on last night. And I don't know if you saw any of the photos floating around yourself, but I realized a lot of them were actually not real photos. Some of them were, there was a bit of creativity involved in them. And so several of the photos that we saw were pictures of city skylines, Nairobi, Mombasa, Mogadishu and other cities around the world with a beautiful supermoon, but unfortunately many of them had been photoshopped, and with some users even showing the comparison of what a fake photo looks like and what a real one would look like. And there were also some very obvious fakes. For instance, Jess Holland from the US wrote, if you can't see a supermoon, put a tortilla on the window. And there were quite a few tortillas and pancakes or chapatis floating around the web there.
But if you want to catch some of the real photos, check out DW Science page, dw.com/science. Or if you are a real space freak, it's always a good idea to check out our posts from NASA official Twitter profile.
That's right. And I think that's all we have from social media this week. Today, that is.
And with that, we come to the end of today's program. Thanks for giving us company. Until tomorrow, same time, I am Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I'm Sela Oneko, and you can follow us on our Facebook page, EW Africa. Thanks a lot for joining us.